Welcome, brave souls, to Stories to Dismember, where nightmares are unleashed and horror takes center stage. Together, we'll embark on a chilling journey to the darkest realms of cinema, dissecting bone-chilling tales that will haunt your dreams. So buckle up, dear listener, as we embark on a cinematic odyssey filled with screams, suspense, and the kind of horror that lingers long after the credits roll. Welcome to a world where fear has a name and nightmares come to life. This is Stories to Dismember, the podcast that will leave you breathless and begging for mercy. Welcome to this week's episode of Stories to Dismember. I am your host, Aaron, and I am here with Ariel and Azrael. Hey, guys.
Hey, hey.
Hello. Hey,
yo, yo. Welcome back, everybody. This week we are doing, well, we are continuing our monthly theme of 1960s movies. And this week we are doing the classic, I guess you'd call it a classic, movie,
oh, yeah.
Rosemary's Baby.
The cult classic.
Yeah.
Yes.
Some people say it's one of the best pictures ever made, or right up there with, you know, like top 10 best picture ever made.
Whoa.
Really?
Okay. We'll have to see how we liked this one.
Yeah. We'll see. All right. So this week, Ariel's going to take it away for us and kind of be our guide through this movie.
All right. Cool. Thank you. Rosemary's Baby, a very well-known movie from the 1960s starring Mia Farrow, who plays Rosemary. Some other actors in this movie that you might know if you're into old school movies like me. Ruth Gordon is in this, and she was in Harold and Maude. I think it's Elisha Cook Jr. is how I'm going to pronounce his name. But he was in The House on Haunted Hill with Vincent Price. And he was also in Blackula. He played the doctor with the hook arm. So shout out to him. And John Cassavetes is also in this. I'm not too familiar with his acting career, but I just thought his name was interesting because his last name is very similar to some of the characters in this movie.
Right.
And some of the characters in this movie have the same first name as the director of this film, Roman Polanski. Mm-hmm. So it was directed by Roman Polanski. He also did the screenplay. It was produced by William Castle, and it's inspired by the book Rosemary's Baby by Ira Levin. And there is also a sequel book by Ira Levin as well called The Rosemary's Son or The Son of Rosemary. I forgot. I haven't read it, obviously. But there was also a TV show that was made a couple years back, I think in 2021, with Zoe Saldana. And it incorporates the two books together into one limited miniseries.
Yeah, so there
I have not seen that.
A recent series on it, and might want to check that out.
Yeah, I don't think I have the streaming service for it, but I do want to check it out.
Speaking of Ruth Gordon, when I started watching this movie and I saw her, I was like, where do I know her from?
Yeah.
And same. I know her from the Clint Eastwood movies, Any Which Way But Loose.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
She kind of has like this Rhea Perlman vibe to her. For people who know who Rhea Perlman is. And then Mia Farrow kind of has a Gwyneth Paltrow look, you know? It kind of, they just look so similar. Yeah. A little bit about Mia Farrow, if you guys don't know who she is. She was married to Frank Sinatra for a short period of time. And then she went on to marry Woody Allen, which was a whole ass thing. a lot of drama there. And another mention about this story that I found kind of strange when you think about it is the director Roman Polanski was married to Sharon Tate, and she was pregnant. She was 8.5 months pregnant and murdered by the Manson family a year after this movie came out. And there was a lot of ties to the Beatles, and there was a lot of ties to Satanism during those murders. So there's a lot going on in this film and a lot in real life that kind of intertwine in a very strange way if you're into that kind of like how things are very coincidental in life and fiction. Yeah. So that's a little bit about the actors and the people who made this film. So I'm going to go into the plot line. And, you know, I have a feeling maybe a lot of people have seen this movie, so I'm not going to get hung up too much on the details. So I'm going to go through it pretty quickly. And then afterwards, we can talk a little bit about maybe some theories, because when I talk to people about this movie, there's a lot of interpretation and a lot of very different interpretation. So I would really be interested to see what you guys had to think about this film and some of the themes as well. So we start out with a man and a woman who is Mia Farrow and John Cassavetes, who's playing Rosemary, and the most ordinary name, Guy. His Guy. Name is Guy.
I said.
Yeah. So they show up to this very sort of vintage gothic looking apartment in, it's called the Bramford, and it's in New York, right? Manhattan or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
New York.
It's on the island. Yeah.
Yeah. Gotcha. It's very beautiful. It's very old looking. The apartment on the, like in the hallways and on the outside, are a little bit run down, but the apartment that they're hoping to rent out is super, super nice on the inside. So whoever lived there before definitely took care of it. It's very beautifully furnished and just what you would expect in a very old school, vintage Victorian apartment. So they are a young couple, and we find out that he is an actor and that she is, you know, just a wife who's, you know, just having a good time, and they're very in love, and this is a big step for them. And he's moving here to do commercials for his acting career, and they decide to move into this place. But while they're touring the unit, it's a very large unit. It has like five bedrooms, five bathrooms. So very large. And they notice that, you know, it's already furnished. The, real estate agent that's showing them around, he's telling them about the previous tenant who lived there. She was like 89 years old. And he said that she slipped into a coma and died in her sleep. But while they're kind of going around, they notice some plants in the apartment, and they were making a joke about how she was probably growing marijuana or something like that, which, you know, back in the 60s, you know, was like a big craze, very popular. And when Rosemary is walking through the apartment, she notices that there's like a handwritten note on the desk, and it says, all it says is, quote, "I can no longer associate myself." And that's it. That's all we get. It's a weird little note left that is not really explained, but again, one of those things that can be left to interpretation. But when they walk out of that room, they see a large like secretary dresser that looks kind of out of place, because there seems to be a spot where it used to be that's all clean, and it looks like it got moved, but it's also blocking a closet door. So they help the agent move the dresser back to its original spot, and he kind of shows them, you know, it's a closet for linens and all that stuff. He said that the woman that lived there previously was kind of off her rocker towards the end, in old age. So he kind of hints that she was kind of going a little crazy before she passed away. So, you know, they are talking to their friend. His name is Hutch. He's like an older friend of theirs, and he's a very intellectual guy, but he's also very honest and blunt and straightforward. He's one of those guys that, if you got a bad haircut, he would tell you it looked bad, which he does in this movie. And so he's telling him, he's like, "Oh, you guys are moving to the Bramford? There's actually a lot of folklore surrounding that place." And they had no idea. So he was telling him, like, you know, back in the Victorian times, there were these two sisters called the Trent sisters. And the lore goes that they used to kidnap and eat children. And then later on, there was a guy named Adrian Mercado that moved in there with his family, and he was trying to conjure a doorway to hell and summon Satan. And people in the town found out about his witchcraft, so they mobbed and lynched him, I think, in the lobby of that building. And then he even said, too, that I think as soon as like a couple years prior, there was like a dead infant child that was found in the basement, and it was wrapped in newspaper. So a lot of like really dark stuff happened in this apartment. But, you know, Rosemary and Guy, they're very lighthearted people. they kind of brush it off like, oh, that's, that kind of sucks. You know, that this place has such a bad kind of like omen about it, but we really love the place and it's not going to shake how much we love, you know, living here. So much so that they have sex in the apartment on their first night moving in. So I guess maybe hearing all that negative stuff really got him in the mood.
I guess so.
There is some nudity in this film. I don't know if it's actually Mia Farrow. It kind of looks like a body double because they don't show her face and the nudity in any of the same scenes. So I'm going to assume it's not her. So Rosemary is down and she's doing laundry because this is back when like laundry washers and dryers weren't in the unit. You had actually had to go to a shared communal space to do your laundry. And it's actually down in the basement. When she's down there doing laundry, she sees a woman and she mistakes her for like an actress. And she says, oh, are you so-and-so? But she, you know, introduces herself and they kind of hit it off right away. And it's a woman about her same age named Terry. And Rosemary finds out that Terry actually lives with this older couple that lives next to their unit called Mr. and Mrs. Cassavetti. Is it Cassavetti? I think it's Cassavet. I can't remember.
It is. Yeah. Cassavet.
Cassavet. Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure because Terry's kind of Italian and we haven't been introduced to them at this point yet. So I think it's Mr. and Mrs. Cassavet.
Cassavetes.
People that kind of.
Cassavetes?
Oh, is it Cassavetes?
Yeah, there isn't. I thought there was an S. I had to verify, but okay. Yeah, Cassavetes.
Yeah, yeah. I wasn't sure. So my bad. So Terry's telling Rosemary that she met them because they took her in off the street and she was hooked on drugs. And I think she also mentioned that she was a sex worker and she was just really, you know, at rock bottom. And they took her in and they really gave her... they treated her like a grandchild, right? She said they're like, you know, pseudo grandparents to me, essentially. They adopted me in a sense, but not, you know, legally. She shows her, you know, that she has like this little necklace with a little charm. It's got like a little locked thing that you can put like herbs and spices in there to make it smell good. She says it's her good luck charm that the Cassavetes gave to her. They say, well, we should come down here together and do laundry because it's really creepy down here. And, you know, we go from there and we don't see Terry again after that until later on.
I did find it weird that in that basement scene when she was talking to Terry, you know, how she said she lived on the streets. And then she thought, mm-hmm. she mentions that she thought the couple wanted her for like a sex thing. She says that to Rosemary. And then Rosemary doesn't really acknowledge it. And she just keeps going on talking.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of odd.
Yeah, it was kind of odd. It was odd to mention that because she goes, oh, you know, this old couple approached me and I thought they were trying to do like some sort of weird sex thing. And she goes, no, they weren't. They were honestly good people. And Rosemary says something like, you know, it's good to know that people like that still exist.
Yes.
And then there's like this strange breaking sound in the basement. It's really weird. It's a very weird scene. I didn't really know how to handle that scene until you find out what happens later, you know?
And you were right. It was Cassavet. The actors, John Cassavetes.
I know. It's so
that's what's confusing me. Yeah. Sorry.
So we will switch. later that night after they meet, Guy and Rosemary are going, you know, a night out on the town and they're going shopping and all this stuff, having conversations, and they're coming back from, you know, their outings, and they find a bunch of police officers in a crowd and they, you know, like kind of poke their head through the crowd to see what's going on. And it's Terry. And it looks like she jumped from a very high part of the building and it kind of looks like a suicide. She's very bloody. Her head's bloody. And there's like a dent on one of the Volkswagen bugs outside. So it looks like she actually hit the car and then hit the pavement. But I thought this scene was very gory. I don't know what it was, if it was the color of the blood, but I just felt it was very gory. What'd you guys think?
The scene, though, is really disturbing because when you're watching a movie, because the movie's kind of a slow build, I guess you can say. I hate using that word too much, but or that phrase. But having that scene, you know, where everything's going good and all of a sudden there's death right in front of everybody laid out. was mm-hmm. pretty shocking.
Yeah, I don't think I was prepared for that. You know what I mean?
Right. Even in that little scene where you meet Terry, you kind of like her.
Yeah, you know, she's beautiful. Yeah. She's nice.
Yeah. And then it makes you suspicious of the old couple. At least it didn't.
Well, yeah. Yeah, because as they're like talking to the police, the old couple shows up. The Cassavetes show up. And now we get to meet them. And the police were also saying like they found a note that was taped to the window with like a Band-Aid. And it looks like it was a note from Terry. And they show it to Mr. Cassavet, and he's like, yeah, that's her handwriting. But they're not, like, they're bummed that she's dead and that she committed suicide, but they're not distraught, you know? So I don't know how long they knew her. Maybe they just recently took her in, like, a month or two ago. But it seems like they cared about her, but not enough to where they didn't show any, like, very deep mourning for her death or, like, shock of her death. No. So they were a little bit shocked that she would commit suicide, but not the fact that she was dead. You know what I mean? So yeah, we meet the Cassavetes, and Minnie, who is the wife, she's very elderly, but she's also very spunky. She mm-hmm. wears a lot of pink. She's kind of, you know, gaudy jewelry, very nosy in your business, but also very nice too. Like, she's well intended. And same with her husband, who his name is Roman. Again, strange coincidence with the director. But Roman is also a very gentle, very sweet, kind, older man. And they just seem like a very great couple together. You know, they don't even bicker, you know. So they just get along great. And they live on the 7th floor, which is that the same? That's the same floor that Rosemary and Guy are on, right? They live yes. right next to her, or yeah. is that above? Okay.
No, right next. Yeah, their apartments are actually connected.
Yeah, yeah. I think they're connected, and I think a little too connected, because yeah. I think later on they hear a lot of the conversations, right. but just like kind of muffled conversations. So very sad that we've already lost, you know, a character that I've already grown fond of. Rosemary starts having some really trippy dreams, and I love, love, love the dream sequences in this movie. Because I feel like they really paid attention to how dreams are for people, like most people, where it's got some loose meaning to reality, but a lot of it is just what the hell is going on? And it just doesn't make sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The first one that we get that Rose has, she's like in not a nunnery, but it's like a Catholic school, and it's got a bunch of nuns, and they're boarding up a window with bricks, and one of the nuns is pissed and saying, you know, we gotta board up the windows because you told her. And you don't even know who they're talking about or what they're talking about. It's supposed to be very disjointed and confusing for a reason. What did you guys think about sort of like the dream sequences in this film?
Like you said, they seem realistic. I thought that they did a really good job of portraying it the way like someone mm-hmm. would dream.
Yeah. Like, things just don't really make sense. They're just very off. Or like, there was like one dream that she had later on where she ate this chocolate mousse, but they kept saying mouse.
And yes.
I'm like, yeah, mouse, that's kind of right. weird. Yeah. Like, that's what would happen in somebody's dream. Like, everybody's just kind of saying things just slightly off.
Yeah. Everything's just a little bit off. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was kind of confused at this point in the movie, because I wasn't sure if this was sort of like a past memory of Rosemary, or if this was just a weird dream that was kind of imitating real life in some way. So I think it was imitating real life, and it seems like she was kind of, because the walls are so thin between their apartment and the next apartment, it seems like maybe she was hearing a conversation in her dream, and this is what manifested in her dream.
Worked its way in.
Yeah, yeah. So they get invited to the Cassavetes for dinner because they're becoming very friendly, especially Guy is kind of becoming more friendly with the older couple because, you know, they don't really know anybody in Manhattan, so they're getting to know their neighbors. They go over for dinner, and I thought this was very interesting, very weird conversation about religion and the Pope and organized religion at this dinner. But Rose notices something about their apartment that I didn't notice the first time around, And I want to say that Rosemary is very attentive to detail. Like she notices everything, and she's very smart. She's always trying to pick up the fine details in a setting or on people. And so they go to the apartment, and when they come back, she goes, "Did you notice that they had pictures that they took down?" And Guy's like, "What are you talking about?" She goes, "Well, there was like a clean spot where a picture used to be. And why would they take that down? Because we were coming over." And you kind of put the pieces together later of what that was. But it, again, it's just something very small, you know, that she picked up on. And, you know, this movie's over 2 hours. So there's a lot of plot. So I just wanted to mention that because she is a very observant person. She's not dumb. She's not oblivious, you know. She is very quick and smart, and she, I think, is a very strong female character, despite what other people might think about her.
Yeah, I think while you're watching the movie, at the surface, she may seem like naive and maybe...
maybe complacent.
Yeah, but she's not. She's definitely not.
No. Yeah, no, she's not. Rosemary is... you know, hanging out with Mrs. Cassavet, because you can't not hang out with her. She comes over to your house every single day, and she brings over her friend, and they've got like this knitting group going on. And poor Rosemary just wants these people out of her house, but Mrs. Cassavet gives her a good luck charm necklace, and guess what? It was Terry's. And Rosemary is like, "Oh, thank you. Yeah, this is so sweet. How thoughtful." And she's like, "Fuck, I gotta wear this now." Right. And even Guy was like, "Well, you took it, so you gotta wear it now." Yeah. And she doesn't really like the charm because of not only its ties to Terry and what happened to her, but also there's like this really stinky herb thing that's going on. Like, instead of putting like potpourri in it, they put something foul. Yeah. And everybody that smells it kind of leans back and is like, "Whoa, what is that?"
And they call it tannis root.
Yeah, yep. It's called tannis root. Which is not a real thing.
No.
And I would know because I'm a pseudo botanist, did horticulture and biology. But yeah, I have some theories about what it is. We can get into it later. But it kind of, you know, has that pungent effect of like smelling cannabis, you know, so people kind of get drawn back from it. Yeah. And so, you know, previously, you know, Guy is trying to, you know, do... what do they call him? He's auditioning for roles, for parts in the town, for commercials. And, you know, he really wants to get into, I think he said he wants to get into film more and get away from commercials. So he auditioned for this part that he didn't get, and he wasn't too bummed about it, but he was like, you know, it is what it is. But after, you know, Rose is gifted this good luck charm, he gets a call like the next day or 2 days later that he got the part. Because the actor that they previously chose all of a sudden went blind and he can't act anymore. So they're like, "Hey, number two, can you take this role on?" And he obviously accepts it. But it means that, you know, they just bought this apartment or renting it. Their whole intent is to kind of start a family. And Rosemary kind of gets upset with this because she's afraid that this is going to take up a lot of his time. Because it is a very serious role for him in his career. And she was really hoping on starting a family with him. And so she kind of gets upset because she feels like he is putting his career first before what she wants in life too. She's just kind of on the sidelines waiting for him to come around to being that family man that he promised he would be. And so he's a little hard on her, and he is hard on her throughout the movie in a very douchey way. But he does come around eventually. I think later that day or the next day, he surprises her with a bunch of, you know, roses in the apartment and apologizes for being an ass to her. And he says, "You know what? I think we should make a baby. Like, we should try seriously. And this new acting thing that I'm going to get is not going to interfere with your pursuit of, you know, trying for a baby." And she's super happy. And he's like, "Let's do it right now." So he's already got it marked on the calendar.
Yeah, he's got the days circled and everything.
Yeah, he's like, "Yeah, these 2 days back to back is when you're ovulating, right?" Like, I don't even know how he picked those days or how he knew how that stuff works, because Guy seems a little too much like a guy. Not really in tune with the feminine body. So later that night, she has another really trippy dream. And this is a wild dream, not gonna lie. I think this is before Mrs. Cassavet brings over some mousse, like chocolate mousse, and they start eating it. And Rosemary is like, I don't really like this. It's kind of chalky tasting. And Guy's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Mine's fine. And so she's kind of eating it a little bit, but she tricks him into thinking that she ate it all, but she actually like kind of dumped it out when he wasn't looking. And she gets kind of lucid a little bit, like a little bit stumbled, and he just kind of plays it off like, oh, she's just drunk. She had a lot to drink. Yeah. And
it's the booze.
They were going to try that night for a baby. So she's like kind of upset because she's like, I really wanted to try tonight. And he's like, you know, there'll be other nights. We can do it again later. And you know, we don't have to do it right now. And he's like, you just feel better. And he puts her down into bed, you know, very sweet. He kind of gets her undressed a little bit so she's more comfortable. But then she kind of slips into a dream. I don't know how to explain this dream. She gets raped by Satan. Like, it's wild.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. That's the scene, yeah.
Yeah, and there's like all these old people. It's kind of like nice in the beginning where she's like floating on water, but then it jumps and she's on a boat, and then they're like, oh, you know, Guy can't come with us or something. Like, it's very dreamlike. And then Satan shows up and she's on an altar table and he just starts going to town on her. And it made me very uncomfortable. It's a very uncomfortable scene. She's not into it. She thinks it's real, but then she also thinks it's a dream. And she wakes up and she asked Guy, she's like, I just had the weirdest dream. Like, I just had a dream that I was raped. And he's like, oh, that's probably because I raped you. And she's like, what? I mean, he doesn't say that verbatim, right?
Right.
But he's like, oh, yeah, no, we did have sex last night and you were totally out. And she's like, what? And he goes, yeah, you know, he makes a joke that I found very disturbing, but he's like, I just wanted to see what it was like if you were like, you know, like a necrophilia kind of thing. He made that comment about necrophilia.
Yeah, it's pretty bizarre.
It's very bizarre. And I was just like, whoa, she just got raped by her husband. And, you know, she thinks that she got raped by Satan. And it's just very shocking. Obviously, this was in the 60s where she's okay with it, obviously, to a certain extent, but also not okay with it because of what happened. There's not really much she can say about the situation because they are trying for a baby, but she does feel very violated. And I think this is when her trust in her husband starts to kind of slip a little bit. You know, this is kind of the tipping point of the scale sliding the other direction. So then I don't know why, maybe you guys have some theories about this, but she goes and she gets her haircut super short, like boy cut short, little boy cut short. It looks good on her, not gonna lie. Everybody else thinks it looks terrible. I had a theory for this because it was very sudden. It was a very sudden cut to her just chopping off all her hair. And she's like, it's Vidal Sassoon.
Yeah, she kept saying that.
Which means
Vidal Sassoon.
Yes.
It's very stylish.
Yeah. How much are we getting paid every time we say that?
Right, right. And they even said, how much did you pay for someone to do that to your hair? I do know that, like, hair for women in various cultures signifies freedom. And I don't know if her being violated so badly like that is why she cut her hair short, is because she feels like she's lost her autonomy at this point. I don't know if there's more to it like that, or if it's just literally just a random thing that they chose for the plot line. But I guess that's one aspect that you could possibly make if that's what's going on here in this scene. Because it is very quickly after the rape scene. So yeah.
It makes sense. It does.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think she does at this point, she's already tested positive for being pregnant quickly after, you know, I think she, either before or after she gets her haircut, but very quickly around that time. And she starts having a little bit of pain with her pregnancy, which, you know, it's her first pregnancy and some things are going to be abnormal, you know, unfortunately a lot, not a lot, but some people do miscarry for their first time. So I think she's kind of scared that maybe she might miscarry, and she's very on top of making sure that she goes to see doctors and gets her vitals done, and just to check with doctors to see what she should be doing and what to expect with the pregnancy. She does go to this doctor. I think his name is Dr. Hill. He does give her like a really good impression, and she really likes what he has to say, and he has a lot of good advice to give her. But she starts going to this other doctor who is recommended by the Cassavetes, and also I think by Hutch, her friend Hutch, recommended Dr. Oh God, what's his name?
Saperstein?
Dr. Saperstein or something like that. Yeah, Saperstein. And he's a well-known obstetrician, but he's got like some different opinions that are more old school than what Dr. Hill has to say. And he starts, you know, saying you need lots of natural vitamins and herbs and supplements, you know, that are really good for you and for the pregnancy. And I'm going to have Mrs. Cassavet make you like a vitamin smoothie every day that will help you with your prenatal vitamins. And I want you to take that every day, and, you know, she'll help you out. But Rosemary starts looking pretty bad very quickly. She starts losing a bunch of weight. She starts getting bags under her eyes. A lot of people are starting to notice. Her friend Hutch is telling her, like, you know, it's not normal to lose this much weight when you're pregnant. And she's like, oh, but I'm gonna gain a bunch of it soon. Like, that's what everybody tells me. And he goes, yeah, but, you know, you're pretty already far along. You should really be concerned about your health. But she's kind of playing it off. A bunch of people are telling her the same thing, so she's starting to believe it, you know, because so many different people are telling her the same thing. And she's kind of just rehearsing whatever people are saying. And they just say, oh, you'll be fine. Or, oh, the cramps will go away soon. It just give it a couple days, you know, and it never happens. Because Hutch is so concerned, he calls her later that night and he says, we really need to talk. I have something to tell you. Can you meet with me privately? She tells Guy about this. She goes, I'm going to go meet Hutch. He wants to talk about something. And she finds out, you know, she goes to meet Hutch and he's not there. So she goes back home or I think she's at a phone booth. Is she at a phone booth at this point? And she calls in and somebody else picks up the phone and says, oh, Hutch, you know, is very sick. He's at the hospital right now. And he got sick, you know, right after you got off the phone with him. And so, you know, it's very concerning, but throughout the rest of the next few scenes, Rosemary doesn't seem too concerned about it. She kind of forgets about Hutch after this, because she kind of gets a little bit consumed with how overwhelmed she is with the Cassavetes and the other apartment tenants just coming over all the time. And she even says to Guy, there's all these old people around all the time. They're always telling me how to do this and how to, you know, be pregnant. And it's just a little too overbearing. And I really miss my old friends. I just want some young people and some liveliness in this apartment. So Rose decides to throw a party. And a bunch of her friends come over, and her friends are very concerned about her health too. And, you know, she's been telling them how she's been having cramps and really bad pain, and nobody's really taking it seriously. But these girls are very concerned about her, and they are convincing her, like, you need to go see a second opinion for an obstetrician or a gynecologist, because this is very serious. And what they're telling you does not sound right. And so they're kind of the harbinger of truth, you know, in this scenario, where they're the only people telling her, we believe you and you need to get help. But Guy is somewhat like he's trying to like stop these women from talking to her, which I thought was very weird and very aggressive. And they even slam the door on him, like push him out and slam the door and lock it on him.
Go away. He's like, but I gotta wash
the. Yeah, she's like, this doesn't concern you.
He's like, but I gotta wash the. And she's like, do it in the bathroom.
Right. They were super like upset with him, you know, but everybody was drunk too. So, I think at this point, Rosemary starts to put together that maybe the protein shake or vitamin shake that Mrs. Cassavet's been giving her is actually not working for the pregnancy, and that she doesn't really know what is being given to her, you know? So she's like, okay, I'm not going to take this anymore. This charm that I'm wearing around my neck, like, it stinks. I'm going to take it off. I'm not wearing it. Like, just I'm going to go see Dr. Hill. I'm going to get a second opinion. And Guy, for some reason, is super fucking pissed that she would do that to Dr. Saperstein. He tells her that that would be an insult to him, to his credibility. And she's kind of like, that's odd, like that you would say that I shouldn't go see a second doctor or a second opinion. And he's like, well, look what you're doing to him. And she goes, and she just blows up. She's like, doing to him? What about me? And then she just goes full on rage on this guy. And understandably so, like nobody has been watching out for her. And she's been suffering for like, what, 5 or 6 months now?
Mm-hmm.
So she's fed up. Like she's not having any of it. So because Guy gets so upset, she starts to realize, I'm going to have to do this behind his back. You know, like I can't let him know that I'm going to go see this doctor. But when she gets a phone call right after this, and she gets a notice that Hutch died. And that's when she realizes, she goes, oh my God, I feel so terrible because I wasn't even, you know, thinking about him this whole time. And now he's dead. So she goes to the funeral. She gets a book that he left her. And the person who gave it to her was like a friend of his. And she said, oh, he wanted me to let you know that the title of the book is an anagram. And it's called All of Them Witches, which I think is a band, like a hard rock band.
Yeah.
Actually, now that witches. I think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I was like, oh my God, that's where they got it from.
Yeah.
So yeah, the title of the book is All Them Witches. And she's like looking through it, and it's got some history about Adrian Mercado and the history of the Bramford. And so that's what Hutch was trying to tell her, was that he discovered something. Because it's supposed to be an anagram, she uses some Scrabble pieces that she has to try to, you know, get the name All Them Witches to say something. But she can't really, like, it just comes out all jumbled words.
That was genius, though, to use Scrabble pieces.
Yeah, because they were playing Scrabble, I think, when they first moved into the apartment. They didn't really have much to do at that point, so they were playing Scrabble. But she's getting nowhere with All Them Witches. So she's like looking in the book a little bit more, and she sees that the name Stephen Mercado in the book is like circled. There's like a little note in there, but she realizes, oh, it's not the name of the book. It's the name of the person in the book is an anagram. So then she tries out Stephen Mercado. She realizes that Stephen Mercado is an anagram for Roman Cassavet. And so, yeah. Roman Cassavet is Adrian Mercado's son. So I thought that was pretty interesting. That's very smart of her to do that.
It was.
And now she's like, okay, Adrian Mercado was a guy who, you know, did witchcraft, was mobbed and lynched in this house. Now his son lives here, and his son is all of a sudden taking, like, him and his wife are taking a very deep interest in me and like insert themselves into my life. So she's starting to make some connections here, but she's also kind of at this state where she's a little bit manic. Like she's so fed up with everything that she's having these nightmares. She just feels like she's been drugged. Like it starts feeling more of like paranoia and a conspiracy to her. And it's really hard for us to, like, it brings us along for the ride, but it's also very hard for us to see it as anything other than psychosis, right?
Right.
She starts making a connection that a lot of these people are actually connected, like Saperstein, the Cassavets, like even the other people in the apartments are all connected. She starts coming up with this elaborate conspiracy theory that they are against her and they are poisoning her and they want her baby or something like that. She's not quite sure. She's kind of all over the place, but she's getting somewhere. So she decides to go to the person that she does actually trust still, and that's Dr. Hill. Because he was the only one that spoke any sort of reason to her in the beginning, and she's trying to explain to him, like, I'm not crazy, I swear, it's just these people are after me. And he's like, okay, I hear you out, like, I totally get it. I'm going to go make a call, and we will get you help. But he goes and makes a call, and he fucking calls Guy and Saperstein to come to his office and drag her out. And I was so pissed at Dr. Hill for doing that.
Yeah,
I'm like, okay, fine, call a psych ward, but don't call the people that she thinks is after her. You know, oh God, I hated that moment. I just wanted to punch him in the face.
Yes, because it seemed like he was going to help her. But then right before he closed the door and he gives her that stare, it's like, he's not going to do it.
Yeah. And I was really hoping he was going to call like a mental health institution and then she would get away from these people. You know, I felt like that was better than what he did, you know, because they take her back to the apartment, you know, and she's like frantic. She's like kicking and screaming and they take her back to the apartment. They inject her with something to calm her down because she is frantic and she's screaming and she's shouting at them. And they say, you know, we need you to calm down because you're about to give birth. Like it's coming. Labor is now. She drifts off because she got drugged again, and she drifts off and she wakes up and they're telling her, you know, unfortunately you lost the baby. It was stillborn, you know, it was too early or something happened, ectopic pregnancy or whatever. But she's not really buying it. Like she's like, no, I feel like my baby's still alive and you guys took the baby. You guys are just trying to, you guys are gaslighting me to feel like this baby died. And she's like, it's alive. It's somewhere in the building. And she's not with anyone at this point, but she grabs a knife from the kitchen, really long knife, like a bread knife. You know, she figures out, like, she remembers everything, even in her drugged state. She remembers that there was something going on with that closet. Somebody was trying to keep something out of that closet with that dresser. And so she figures out that closet is a passageway to somewhere. So she goes through the passageway. She makes herself into... Now, is this the Cassavetes apartment, like another section of the apartment, or a... They called it like a partition. So is this what's between their apartment and the Cassavetes?
Yeah, because early in the movie, Terry mentions that like they're connected to the back of their apartment or something like that.
Yeah, but I don't think when they went over for dinner that they were in this room specifically.
No.
So I think it's a room that's attached to the Cassavetes apartment that's also like on the other side of their wall too, because they could hear a lot of stuff going on. And like right before Terry died, like that night before, I think they were like hearing like chanting or something too. So it was like kind of weird that they were hearing that stuff. And, you know, at that point you're like, okay, well maybe she's just hearing something and thinks that it's chanting, or maybe they're singing hymns.
She also heard a baby cry too when she was laying in bed.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's why she mainly thinks that the baby's still alive, because she can hear the baby crying because the walls are so thin. So she grabs a knife. She goes into their apartment and there's all these people there, all these people that we've seen throughout the entire film, except I think the black guy that works at the apartment, he's not there. And he's kind of one of those people that's consistent throughout the film, but really has nothing to do with any of this. He's actually the only good character here, him and Rosemary. But she notices that there's all these random people that are joined together, and there is a black crib that is draped in like a veil, very like Victorian style, and it has like an upside down cross on it, and everybody's like, huzzah, you know, hail Satan. they're like, oh, Rosemary, you made it. Oh, and you brought a knife. How great. Why didn't you go check out your baby? And she like goes up to the crib. I think they get the knife out of her hands at this point, because I'm like, don't go near the baby with the
knife.
She
dropped it. See, there's little comedic moments in this whole movie where she dropped it.
Yeah.
So Minnie goes over and pulls it out of the floor, and then she rubs the floor to make sure it didn't leave a mark.
Leave a mark.
Yeah, because she was really upset, like when her husband like spilled some wine on the carpet or something. She's so just clumsy. Mark. Yeah, so clumsy. I just got these carpets replaced. So she goes over to the crib. We never see the baby, just so y'all know. We never see the baby. We do see like an overlaid image of what the eyes might look like. So she's like horrified when she sees the baby. And she's like, what did you do to his eyes? And you're like, oh, fuck, what did they do to his eyes? But it's just that his eyes are demonic. And they said, oh, he has his father's eyes, right? It's not Guy. I can tell you that much. Guy does not have yellow demon eyes. And they overlay that imagery of Satan when he was raping her in that dream. And so you just imagine like this baby has yellow demon eyes, which is terrifying. He has like hooves for feet because they said, oh, look at how cute his feet are. And his little claws. So they're kind of like more and more people are showing up. to, you know, see this. It's kind of like at the manger, right? Everybody shows up to see this baby because it's supposed to be Satan's, you know, spawn, essentially, and it's going to be the Antichrist, right?
Yeah. They keep saying year one, too. Year one.
Yeah, year one. Yeah. And I think the baby's, what they named it is Adrian, right?
Yeah.
Not Damon, but missed opportunity. But one of the things I thought, another comedic thing I thought was funny about this scene was the Asian guy taking photos.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was pretty hilarious.
He's like some happy Asian dude just taking photos of everything. And he's like totally not reading the room that Rosemary is not having a good time. And he's like taking pictures of her. He's like smile.
Yeah. Pointing at her, pointing at the crib, you know, in the camera and take a picture.
And even when he says Hail Satan, he's like, Hail Satan.
Yeah.
He's just kind of out there.
He's like off a beat too, because everybody says it and he's like lagging behind.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're congratulating her and they're like, you know what, I know that this is fucked up, like this isn't what you probably imagined in your head of starting a family, but I think you really need to be a mother to this Antichrist. I think you should really go over there and I think you should try, you should just try, because that's what I think would be best for you. And she's just like really wants to stab these people. She really wants to fucking murder these people, understandably. So her husband guy reveals to her the whole plan all along, and obviously he's there, so he's in on it, but we didn't know up until this point like how involved he was. And then we find out this motherfucker was paid and was gonna have his career advanced. He was promised that his career would advance if he gave up his wife's uterus to harbor and give birth to the Antichrist. He set her up completely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was just like, damn, you, this guy is the worst person in this whole movie, you know, because these people are just, you know, satanic cultists. But this guy really, really betrayed her. And I have a question that we can talk about later about when that deal was actually made, because I'm kind of confused on that part. But I'll just wrap this up real quick. So we get the last scene of the movie where Rosemary is just kind of like so shocked and traumatized that she's just kind of like, she can't believe what's going on. She's just kind of like a walking zombie at this point. She walks over to the crib and she's like looking at the baby, and her expression doesn't change, but she's just kind of like very calm at this point, but obviously not content. And she's just starts rocking the crib and the baby stops crying. You know, because this whole time the baby was crying and she's just kind of rocking the crib back and forth and looking at the baby. The baby stops crying. And then you just get this la, 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 la singing little lullaby. And that's the end of the film. And that's also what we started out with, was that little la, la, lullaby sung by Mia Farrow. So that's it.
All right. Rosemary's Baby. 1968 had the twist ending, I guess some people call it.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. I heard you had some questions, discussion points.
I got some, I got some fun facts first though.
Okay. Just
Yeah. Cause I, you know, like I always do, I went down a lot of rabbit holes for this movie. I also had to get myself familiar with Mia Farrow again. Because I kind of knew that she was married to Woody Allen, Frank Sinatra. But I found some interesting tidbits, which also kind of relate to the sequel book to this whole franchise thing, Rosemary's Baby, and then the son of Rosemary, and or Rosemary's son. I forgot which it is. But so Mia Farrow's sister. So Mia and Mia Farrow's sister went to India to study some sort of Buddhism, some sort of spiritual Buddhism. And they went to this retreat. They were there with all of the Beatles during this time. And the Beatles were very famously known for also being at this retreat, which I believe inspired the entire album of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club. So Mia's sister's name is Prudence. And I don't, if you're familiar with the Beatles, you will know that there is a song called Dear Prudence. That song was made specifically for Mia's sister, Prudence.
Oh, wow. I never knew that.
Wow.
More of a Stones fan, so.
Oh, well, that explains a lot. I'm just kidding. I am a Beatles fan.
Are you?
More of a Beatles fan than a Stones fan, but I do like them equally. So another tidbit that I thought was very interesting was the sequel, like I said. That whole like book from Ira Levin was dedicated to Mia Farrow. So the book is about like the main character, Rosemary. And what do you know? She goes to some of her dreams are in a strawberry field. And a lot of it has to do with like her dreaming about John Lennon and all this trippy stuff about her and her son, the Antichrist and all this stuff. So I thought that was very interesting that she had such a connection to the author of the story that he had then decided to make a sequel that had a lot of real parts of Mia's life in it.
That's cool.
Anyways, yeah. All right, questions. Do you guys think that Terry was the original plan to harbor the Antichrist and give birth to the Antichrist?
Yes. Ding, ding, ding.
I think she may have been involved.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Yeah. I think.
By the way, none of these are actually like have correct answers.
Oh, yeah.
it almost seems like opposite, but I don't think maybe. Because Rosemary was more of a good human.
Innocent?
Yeah, innocent.
Not a drug addict?
Yeah. So the vessel would be more pure, I guess.
Yeah. What do you think, Azrael?
I think maybe she was involved, Terry was involved in their satanic doings. I don't know if maybe necessarily she was lined up to be like what Rosemary was.
Hmm. Okay. I think that she was, but then they realized maybe a former drug addict is not there's going to be complications with the pregnancies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they tried with Terry because she was wearing the good luck charm.
Yeah.
Maybe they tried with Terry and realized this isn't a really good plan and this new girl just moved in and she actually seems like a better fit for the whole plan. So maybe they pivoted. And then that brings me to my next question. Do you think that, I guess this is a three question. Do you think Terry actually committed suicide? Or do you think that she was killed because she could no longer serve as the vessel? Or do you think that she was killed as a sacrifice to help Rosemary conceive?
I like the last one. The sacrifice.
You do?
Yeah.
Because they were chanting.
Yeah.
I was like, why would you chant if you're just killing somebody to get rid of them?
Right. I agree.
What do you think, Aaron?
Yeah, no, I agree. I like the last one.
You think she was sacrificed?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's keep going. All right. Previous tenant that lived there. We didn't get much information on her, so I thought this was a really cool rabbit hole to go down. She left that note that saying that she couldn't be associated with this anymore. So she was obviously like cursed and killed from the cult, but why do you think they had her killed?
She knew too much.
That's a good answer.
Yeah, do you think she knew too much and was leaving the cult?
Yeah, there's no leaving the cult.
Yeah.
To me, I would think
it's right. One of those deals when you're in, you can never get out type of thing.
Right. If you're either in or you're dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if she was part of the cult at some point, but then maybe the plan pivoted to, you know, awaken the Antichrist or give birth to the Antichrist. And she's like, I think this has gone too far. Like, this was fun and all, but I didn't know you guys were actually serious about this.
She's like, I got to grow my little herbs and make my little smoothies.
which brings me to my next thing that I also went down. So this whole good luck charm thing with the herb in it and the fact that the previous tenant was growing herbs in her apartment. I think it was even mentioned that she was growing herbs for Mrs. Cassavet. I was thinking, like, because they were talking about how pungent it was. And even Hutch, when he smelled it and looked at it, he's like, it kind of looks like a fungus. Like, it's kind of moldy. It's got a weird, like, it doesn't look like herbs at all. It kind of looks like something dead, right? Being like rotted almost. And then I was thinking, because tannis root doesn't actually exist, but I was like, okay, what is a hallucinogenic fungus that would cause psychosis like this. And I found out that, which is something that was actually tied to the Salem witch trials, was this thing called ergot, which is a fungus that infects rye and other grains. And so, like, with the whole Salem witch trials, people were accidentally ingesting this, and it's so LSD, which, you know, everybody knows is, you know, that hallucinogenic drug, it's actually derived by ergot. So it has the same component. So it has the same effect on humans when they ingest large amounts of it. And so it does have a smell to it that's very pungent, so much so that animals tend to avoid it. They can tell when, like, something has been infested with ergot, and they just won't eat it. And so I'm wondering if the previous tenant that lived there was producing ergot, giving it to the Cassavet, saying, this will help with your guys' plan, right? Once the plan was revealed to her, she's like, go ahead and give this, you know, to around their neck, and it'll help with the pregnancy and all this stuff. But ergot is also has been used in the past in, like, Mesopotamian times. If in small amounts, it can induce abortions. And so I'm wondering if the previous tenant had an underlying plan that she was going to give it to Terry to make sure that Terry didn't get pregnant. And then whoever was wearing it would, you know, mess up the pregnancy, essentially. They obviously didn't find out because they then gave it to Rosemary. But I wonder if she kind of was plotting something beneath the surface.
Well, that's actually a really good theory.
Because it's not explained, and I just don't like that.
Right.
I'm going to find out, damn it.
Right. And I spent a whole hour on that, okay?
Wow. That's a really good idea. That seems feasible.
Nobody has come up with that. So I'm like, I gotta figure out something before we do this episode, because I need to explain this somehow.
And obviously the coven didn't know, because they still used it.
Yeah.
Even though she was dead.
But she was having complications with her pregnancy the whole time.
Yeah.
Right.
And she did not start getting better until she stopped wearing that necklace.
Right.
Took it off.
Yes. So I think the previous tenant was, like, giving these things to the Cassavetes, but it was actually, like, plotting against what they were trying to carry out.
I like it.
And that's why she, like, blocked the door and everything. Because she's like, fuck, they're going to find out.
Yeah, that's a really good theory. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And maybe that's why Terry couldn't get pregnant, you know? So, next question. This is something that I need clarification on. How long did the husband plan this whole thing? Was this before they moved, or was this after they moved?
I think it had to be after they moved, once he didn't get that part.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too, because I think he went on a walk with Roman. And he's like, oh, we're going to talk. Do you want to come? And she's like, no, I'm good. And I think that's maybe when this whole plot was, like, pitched to Guy.
Yeah, because after that, he was really enthusiastic about going back there and hanging out with them.
And having a baby. Yeah.
Yep.
Because right after that, he's like, hey, I talked it over. I think we should really have a baby now, you know? And I'm like, oh, that motherfucker. That's when he was propositioned for this whole plan.
Yeah,
definitely. I think I agree on that point.
Okay.
That's what I had in the back of my head when I was watching it.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, good. Because then I was thinking, well, did they kill the previous tenant to make room for Rose? Like, how far back did this plan start, you know? And so, but then I was like, I think it was just, things kind of fell into place naturally, and then the plan developed coincidentally. Because the Cassavetes weren't really interested in them until they found out that Rosemary and him were trying to have a kid. And that's when they really amped up their interest in this couple. Because I think Rosemary made a mention, like, oh, I have, like, 14, like, cousins, and our family's super fertile. And they're like, huzzah! And, you know,
we're,
like, super stoked. Yeah, have a bunch of babies. Have 7, you know? My next question, which is something that I've heard before about the ending of this film and theories about what's actually going on, because this is a psychological thriller. Do you guys think that everything actually happened the way it did? Or do you think this is all in Rosemary's head and she's just having a psychotic episode and this is all a dream or something like that?
I think it all happened. I don't think it was a dream.
What do you think, Aaron?
I do think it all happened. there's parts in the movie, like the dream sequences, that could might make you think it wasn't, because she did have such lucid dreaming. But I do think it all happened. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think her husband was was a shit for doing all this to her.
Yeah, he was an actor, right?
Yeah,
I think so too. Some people were like kind of speculating if it was, if it all actually did happen, or if some parts happened and others didn't, which what was reality. But I do think it all happened. It just, there would have to be too many other inconsistencies for this to just be all in her head, right? You know? So I do think it did happen. It did happen. But yeah, I mean, that's all the questions I have. So yeah, thanks for answering all those, guys.
Did anybody, or did you look up anything in the research about who actually played the character of the devil?
No, I didn't. Who did?
It was Anton LaVey. Uncredited, purposely.
No.
Yeah.
No, really?
Yes. Yep.
What?
Yeah.
What?
I think purposely they didn't want him credited for the film, but he played the devil.
Well, of course, because then that would ruin like the film for the rest of time, because oh my god, yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah, I forgot to
holy
mention
shit.
It. And then also, what do they mention? This is the new year.
Year one.
Year one,
and which is what Anton LaVey said about the First Church of Satan, because it started that same year.
Yeah.
1966.
Yeah. Oh, 1968.
Or 68.
Yeah.
Is it?
Huh. Interesting. I didn't know that.
So, yeah.
Well, I'm sure he loved that part.
Oh, yeah. He's like, this is normal for me.
He's like, I was born for this.
This is Tuesday night. What are you talking about?
Right? He's like, you want me to bring my my furry costume that I wear on Tuesday nights?
Which there is an interview, if you look him up. I can't think of the host's name. But this is in the early life of Anton. And he's wearing his cape and everything. And the host is like poking fun of him, making fun of his name. You know, Xandor's middle name. And about, do you sleep in a coffin? And he was pretty like, he took it pretty well. And he was actually kind of joking back and forth. He didn't seem too upset by it. It was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think he did pretty well in interviews from what I've seen. I haven't done extensive research on him. I have like read the book that he wrote, but very like with a grain of salt, you know, kind of approach to it. I was just more interested to see what he had to say and what he produced. And yeah, like you said, he was actually pretty good with interviews, and he knew that people were going to punch down with him. Yeah. So he was kind of prepared for it. But he was very like, he was very cocky. And I think that just lended to his like whole personality, you know?
Yeah, I agree. So yeah, I think the movie, I think it's really a timeless horror masterpiece. I think everything was done really well. The directing, the story, and the acting, I think they're really outstanding. You know, at this 60s, 70s, you kind of had those slow burn type films, that gradual buildup of tension. I think it still really holds up for compared to today's standards of horror movies. So to me, it is one. I think it's one of the best psychological / satanic horror movies of all time. I think it's something definitely worth watching if you haven't seen it. And it's a movie that I think you can watch on a regular basis. It's not something you just watch once and say, I've seen it. I think it's something you can do on a regular basis. So for me, I give it a 8.8 Tannis Roots.
Believe it or not, this was the first time I've seen this movie. I mean, kind of holding it off.
Oh my God.
You know, to do it for the show.
First take.
Yeah. And I like the fact, I know a lot of people don't, that the ending doesn't really answer many questions. I kind of like movies like that because I like to fill in the ending myself in my head somehow, you know. And I can understand why people don't, because you're kind of left with, okay, you know, because her last look in the last scene, it looks like she wants to be this little guy's mother, you know. So where does that go? I really did enjoy this movie. It is pretty long. It's 2 hours or over 2 hours.
Like 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Yeah. And the acting, like Azriel said, was good. It's like all the characters are believable, which I like. You can look at these people and actually see them being that person, you know, that they're portraying in the movie. Yeah, it is from the 60s, so there's a plot. There's a lot going on. You got to think sometimes. You got to figure stuff out. which is good. You know, it's not like the new movies where they just, you know, in the first 15 minutes, they would have showed us what the baby looked like. Saying all that, like Ezreal said, this is a good movie to watch and rewatch. And I probably will rewatch it again to see what I missed. Because, you know, movies like this, you need to watch a couple of times before you notice everything. Like there was a scene where she goes, did you notice that Roman had his ears pierced?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when he came over to her house, they kind of focused on his ear, basically. You know, his little things like that. And it's cool. They have little comedic moments in the movie. They kind of make you giggle, which breaks the tension a little bit.
Yeah, it kind of breaks up.
Like when they brought Rosemary back from the doctor's office, Dr. Heels, and they have her on the bed. There's a scene with Rosemary after they pick her up from Dr. Heels' office and she escapes from the doctor and her husband, and she runs back to the apartment and she locks herself in and they can't get in, and she's in the bedroom and there's, you see these two guys just cross the hall like do 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 do, you know.
Oh, they snuck past. Yes.
And then, you know, everybody comes busting in after that, but they kind of just like sneak by or something. That was funny. Saying all that, I will give this movie 8 out of 10 little Antichrist babies.
Nice.
I like that. Well, that's great that you really liked it on your first watch. I think this was probably my third time watching it, but I had watched this so long ago that I forgot the middle parts of the movie, because again, it's a really long movie. It's hard to remember all the little pieces that fit together. I just kind of knew the beginning, the middle, and the end, essentially. And I always like kind of remember the end because it's, you know, it doesn't give you what you want. So you kind of feel a little bit left unsatisfied. But at the same time, I like that unsatisfaction because then it kind of leads people to kind of speculate and make their own interpretations. But with that said, I want to say, like, out of a lot of movies that I've seen, the dream sequences in this movie have been the most accurate in terms of what dreams are actually like for people. And I don't know why movies don't do that more often, but I felt like there was a lot of care and thought put into making this movie feel very realistic down to the dream sequences. I really applaud this movie for doing that in 1968. A lot of the camera shots and the use of color were absolutely stunning and beautiful. A lot of the shots looked a little tricky and looked like maybe it was hard to do. So they really kind of pushed the envelope in this film with certain types of shots. And also like different angles too, like the shot of Mrs. Cassavet through the door and kind of having like a fisheye lens kind of thing that wasn't really asked for from Roman Polanski, but he just did it anyways. He was a very ambitious director and kind of wanted to be different, you know, stylistically and also with his film's plot. And so even though this movie is 2 hours and 15 minutes, I really feel like it's as long as it needs to be in a sense, because I can't imagine cutting any of the scenes out. All the scenes kind of fit together and had a purpose. None of them felt like they were there just for fluff, or that they didn't explain something in the plot or didn't develop a character. So I do like this movie because every scene did feel necessary and didn't feel boring. I thought that it was a little slow with the pacing, but I think the buildup of her idea of the conspiracy kind of, it carries you along. And also the comedic reliefs kind of remind you in the movie, like, hey, you know, like this is supposed to be still an entertaining film. It's not supposed to be all doom and gloom. So there is a lightheartedness about it that you probably wouldn't have expected. And that's why I feel like that the first death scene is very shocking, because you weren't expecting it. And so this movie is not going to scare you. You know, it's going to be creepy and unsettling, but it does not have jump scares. It does not have gore. You know, some people really like that in horror movies. This is not that movie. It's more of a mystery psychologic horror movie. I just thought overall, like, I gotta say, like, this movie is great through and through, and I would give it a 10 out of 10 good luck charms.
Woohoo!
Excellent.
Yeah, this is a masterpiece movie for me, and I don't say that lightly, honestly.
Well, all right. That was Rosemary's Baby from 1968. And if you're playing along at home and want to know what movie we're doing next, we are going to be doing Psycho from 1960, an Alfred Hitchcock movie. So we got a bunch of heavy hitters for the 60s movies, which it's a lot of fun to revisit these movies. And
yeah, and Aaron, you'll get to watch Psycho for the first time.
You've never seen it?
For the first time this year, yeah. Oh. No, I've seen it, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I was just messing with him because he didn't see Rosemary's Baby for his whole life.
I know. Well, I read somebody else had a review, and they were my age, and they were like, I haven't watched it either. You know, it's one of those deals where if you would ask me before I saw it, I probably could have gave you 75% of the movie just because it's so much in our popular culture.
It's so iconic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of knew what was coming and what was going on, just not the details.
Well, I'm sure the same could be said about Psycho too. If you have not seen the film, you probably already have a gist of what it's about just based on all the scenes that get spliced into other movies and being talked about.
Yeah, especially
Jamie Lee Curtis's mom.
Didn't they just have a series a while back?
There was a series, I think, right?
Oh, there was?
Yeah.
Or maybe I'm thinking Bates Motel.
I'm really bad with series.
That is Bates Motel, right?
Oh, yeah. Bates Motel. Yeah, Bates Motel. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I did watch Bates Motel. Yeah. I only watched, like, I think the first two seasons.
Yeah. I don't think it went very long, so when I got most of it.
Yeah, I think it only went, like, 6 or 7 seasons, if that.
All right. Well, appreciate you guys hanging out with us. You can reach us at storiestodismember@gmail.com. You can leave us a message, either text or a voice message at 817-405-4196. You can also hit us up on Facebook at Stories to Dismember and look us up on Instagram and TikTok. So that should be coming. Those will be updated soon. Like I said, I'm glad you joined us. Glad you're here. Hit the like, subscribe, tell your friends. It's probably the best thing to do is tell your friends, check us out. We'll see you next time.
La 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 la.
Thank you for listening to the Stories to Dismember podcast. Please be sure to tell your friends, subscribe, and leave a rating. You can contact us at storiestodismember@gmail.com, and we'd love to hear from you. You can also follow us on TikTok at Stories to Dismember. The music for Stories to Dismember is provided by Windfeather. Can't wait to hang out with you next time. Bye-bye. Well, at that precise moment, my wife walked by and saw the screen and she goes, "Slugbug."
Yeah. That's hilarious. I love that. Did she hit you? She punched you in the face?
She was too far away. She chased me down before she got a good one.
She's like, "I'll get you next time."
Mm-hmm.